Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide. And we want to head to, for the benefit of my listeners, New Orleans. Of course, my guest, Dr. Laura Kelly, pronounce New Orleans, rather New Orleans, I would assume, as I welcome my guest, Laura D. Kelly, Dr. Laura Kelly, born in New York City, but has a PhD, a historian, and recently, I hadn't heard of you, Dr. Kelly, until I wound up in Leitrim. Actually, at Anya Sheridan's sister's house in Calgarran, and there was a lot of talk about you. And they talk about everybody, but in your case, it was actually positive. You, as an author, of The Irish in New Orleans, which you wrote some years ago, but is still very much a lauded book. So I had to get a little educated myself with respect to not only you, but eyebrows were raised when it said Margaret of New Orleans, Margaret, mother of orphans, and I figure, what the heck is everybody talking about? But anyway, you're very welcome to the program, and I want to again ask you just an overview of the Irish and the history of the Irish in New Orleans.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, hello. Thank you. Thank you for the call, and hello to all the folks out in Margaret's birthplace in Carrigaline. The last time I was there was in 2016 when they had their international jazz, trad, and food festival, which was just great crack, as they would say. Yeah, Irish New Orleans, who knew, right? People are used to hearing about Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, but they don't really turn their eyes south to New Orleans, and they should for many reasons. And one of them is because the Irish experience here in New Orleans was different than it was in other places in North America. To begin with, we don't have that British colonial experience or heritage or history. We were a French colony and then a Spanish colony, and then very late the Americans bought us, much to the chagrin of the people living here. It's a Catholic city. It still is a Catholic city. So in a Protestant nation, it stood out for that reason as well. But it also meant that the Irish experience here was different. Our first Irish immigrants that come here come via two-step process. They have people who have left Ireland, went to France, and from France came over to Louisiana when it was a French colony, or left Ireland, went to Spain, and when it was a Spanish colony, came over through that route, frequently through the military. Later on, in the age of sail, New Orleans was first the largest port, and then New York City eclipsed it in the late 1830s, but it was then the second largest port. So a lot of people started coming directly, but we offered something that other cities in America couldn't, and that was, again, being a Catholic city and having that heritage and welcomeness. And So the experience here is different. In some ways, it's also familiar because New Orleans was a port city, and there's a lot of the commonality of different different immigrant groups coming in, making your own different neighborhoods and establishing yourself. Interesting enough, for anybody who's ever been to New Orleans, and I'm from, you know, I was born in New York City, and when I first came to New Orleans, and I had this taxi driver, and I thought he was from New York, and I asked him when he moved to New Orleans, and he said to me, "Move, I've never left, you know, I'm from the Channel, the Irish Channel." It was such a strong, almost Bronx accent, and I was flabbergasted by it. And I later found out that the reason that this New Orleans accent is so similar to New York is because when they began to switch to speaking English here as the main language, was the same time that we got that massive wave of Irish immigrants due to the Great Famine. And those that came in were speaking English at a time when the city itself was transitioning from a predominantly French-speaking place to an English-speaking place. So all of that kind of shaped it and shaped the heritage of the city here, and it's just it's good fun. And so if you're looking for a different slice of Irish America, then I welcome all of your listeners to please come to New Orleans.
I want to actually ask you, Laura, about the Irishing of, I know that's not a word, but we'll let it pass, of New Orleans. It was actually Ireland, or New Orleans was indeed quite Irish long before the famine, at the turn of the century, before the famine.
Yeah. So that's a really good point. So we had Irish coming here from the very foundation of New Orleans, which was in 1718. And as I mentioned before, we have Irish coming in through French military, Spanish military. Some we have Irish priests that come over. And get established here. We have, after the 1798 rebellion in Ireland, we get some of those political exiles who get established here. And I had found in my research the earliest sort of public celebration of St. Patrick's Day happening in 1806. And to put that into context for your listeners, 1803, December of 1803 is when the Louisiana Purchase officially happened, when we transitioned into American hands. So this is 2.5 years later, and we're having what would have been a very recognizable public celebration of St. Patrick's Day with governor involved, judges involved, you know, traditional toast, non-traditional toast to Ireland, and you see it reoccurring after that. You see the first philanthropic organization, association, the Hibernian Association, established in 1818. So, again, in response to events in Ireland where the end of the Napoleonic Wars, agricultural crisis and economic crisis, growing some typhus, and things were hitting Ireland pretty hard on all kinds of different levels, and you see another kind of mass out migration out, typically male, single men moving out, and they come here, and there's enough of a population, and they're arriving not in the best of health, that they form this association to provide a doctor, to provide help, to provide means specific to Irish. To the Irish immigrants coming in. So that's also 1818, 1819. And then we have our first Catholic church outside of the French Quarter was St. Patrick's here. So that whole kind of foundation of an Irish community and what we kind of look for as historians, like markers to sort of see the establishment of a community, of an ethnic community, were well in place, 10, 15 years before the Great Hunger and that massive wave that, of course,
yes,
came to New Orleans, went to every corner of the earth.
Dr. Laura Kelly, want to first of all bring it back to my own recent trip to Ireland and meeting a very enthusiastic Carrigallen County Leitrim based group called Margaret of Norland's Tully Committee. Tully being the townland, I assume, at least I'm. So, and it was, they have actually just, you know, restored, you know, this Margaret's birthplace, her cottage, using original stone. But who is Margaret of New Orleans? Where is she?
So, yeah, she's probably one of my favorite people to talk about and to let other people know about. In many ways, she embodied the Irish immigrant woman experience. Came over to America at an early age, orphaned, gets married, moves to New Orleans shortly within a year of arriving in New Orleans. Her husband and her baby, her only child, both died. So now she's a widow, you know, in a strange city, and she's working at St. Charles Hotel, so she's working in the domestic service. She's illiterate. But then what she does is she seeks comfort and refuge and succor in not only the Catholic Church, but specifically with the Sisters of Charity, who were running the female orphan asylums here in New Orleans. And there were a lot of Irish American girls that were at this orphanage. And she just donating her time, donating her energy. She decides to buy 2 cows so the orphans have fresh milk. And, you know, within 2 years, she's got multiple cows, a full-blown dairy business. She's selling milk around the city. She's collecting goods for the orphanages. And from there, she really just expands on her business and obviously a very savvy individual. She gives out small business loans. She's all over our material archives creating contracts. And it's striking because when you see these contracts, she's still signing everything with an X because she's illiterate. And she, it makes one pause and say, you know, don't conflate the two because you're unable to read and write, that you don't have a tremendous amount of knowledge, resource, and expertise, which she obviously did.
Yeah.
She continued to work with the sisters. She helped to fund another asylum, St. Vincent's, because unfortunately New Orleans, as were major urban areas here, we were prone to yellow fever epidemics, cholera epidemics, at a time when we didn't understand the transmission of disease. These things just spread like wildfire. And Irish immigrants oftentimes were the victims and leaving many children orphaned, unfortunately. So she continued that support in expanding upon sort of the welfare needs, the needs of the Irish community here as it grew and expanded. And eventually ended up through a series of loans in 1859, owning a bankrupt bakery, called Deccan. And what was amazing about that was, one, it's 1859, so to put your Irish listeners in perspective, a year later, the U.S. Civil War is going to break out. And everything in America, and especially in the South, is about to change. But we're going to be at war in America, and she takes over a bankrupt bakery, and she makes it a massive success. Ends up being the largest bakery in the South. She introduces steam power. She learns how she figures out a way to package the biscuits, send them. She's making 800 pounds of flour for sale per day. And during all of this, she's still giving away bread. She's still continuing with her charitable causes and the philanthropy, and of course with the orphan asylum. So just a phenomenal, phenomenal woman.
Now, and I want to ask you, Dr. Laura Kelly, about now when you say asylum, that is orphanages were called asylum, having nothing to do with mental instability, or
For that clarification, yes, orphanages. That would have been just the term that they used at the time, the 19th century. But no, this was the institution for that.
Yes. And was she, when she supported the orphanages, there was really no particular Irish angle or affinity for what she was doing. These were orphanages. They weren't Irish orphanages. They weren't solely run by the sisters. What was the mix like back in those days with respect to the services of an orphanage?
Several things happened. So the Sisters of Charity arrived in New Orleans about 1829, 1830, and they were invited by the city to come in and to take over the main hospital for the city and to run it. So they were brought in to do that, and then within a few years, or actually from the very beginning, they were running one of the asylums, it fell into Protestant hands, and so they left that and began their own in the late 1830s. So again, the orphan asylum or the orphanage was created before the Great Hunger and the mass migration, again, because of the yellow fever epidemic, the cholera epidemic, with things like that. The composition was largely Irish. The girls there represented, there was majority Irish American. The nuns, the sisters were, many of them were Irish. And although others would have been welcomed, but this is also the South during the antebellum period, and so any orphans that were children of color, free people of color, or that it would have been free people of color, they had their own orphanage that they went to, one that was run by a sister by the name of Henriette DeLille, because there was a strict color line in the city. So segregation in that respect existed. And the Creole population here, they had such strong kinship networks, family networks that went back generations, that I think a child that would have become orphan would have been adopted by an aunt or an uncle, you know, an immediate family member. But of course, with immigrants, is that you're that first level, that first entry, and frequently there isn't that kinship network that's been established yet. And if you have an epidemic that hits an entire community, everybody's affected by it, so the resources of neighbors can be sort of limited. With the 1840s, about a decade later, we start to get a lot of Irish nuns. We get Dominicans who come over. We have Sisters of Mercy. We have Christian Brothers. We have a lot. And I know that for the New Orleans experience, that relationship with the Catholic Church was a positive one. It was a supportive one. It was one that provided the safety net, and the face of that were these sisters that worked in the community. And I should mention that these same sisters that ran the orphanage also ran the school and the hospital. So if you were sick, go to school or anything else, these were the sisters that you saw. And these orphanages were right in the heart of the Irish neighborhoods. They weren't like, the Sisters of Charity were not removed. The Sisters of Mercy were not removed. They were every day right within working with and, you know, collaborating with. And some of my research with the orphanages is fascinating because we think of it as sort of a permanent stop. And it, whoops, easy.
Sorry.
And it wasn't, that's right. It's a lot of times these families, you see them bringing a child in at the beginning of an epidemic, and 3 or 4 months later, a family member is picking them up again. So they're kind of stopgap measures instead.
Yes.
And bringing children to a place that I think would have been seen as one of safety and, you know, during scary times. And we've just all been through the COVID epidemic. We see how paralyzing that can be. And imagine understanding how the disease is being transmitted and the high death rates, you know, thousands of people dying and things like that. So that respect, bringing a child to an orphanage is bringing them to a place of safety. And then you could come back with them. It wasn't a one-way street.
Yeah. And also, of course, yellow fever being rampant at that time, you know, which Margaret Hahare would have been, or Hahare would have been more than familiar with, in the sense that, you know, the coming from a country where, and coming from a particular area of Ireland, where, you know, families were borderline starvation, they had to go somewhere, which brings me back to her leaving Ireland with her parents and two siblings, and the custom of having, there were a family, there were six children, I believe, and three of them remained behind with an uncle, you know, so that when the family could be established here, they would then, you know, send the ticket to bring the others over. Was that prominent in New Orleans at that time, or has history just taken wiped that one to the side?
No, so yeah, what you're talking about is called chain migration, and that was very common. Tickets were, especially when you're coming from a cash-poor society, the tickets represented a huge amount of one's wages. And so when you couldn't afford to bring everybody over, you did it piecemeal. And you did it as you could afford to do it, and you'd send the maintenance back home and then bring over another family member. And this was a strategy that many Irish used around the world. Sometimes, you know, sometimes communication fails and you're, no paper letters that a sister arrives and she can't find her brother, she can't find her family, and she posts something in the Boston Pilot looking for them. But it did work for many, and it was, we had offices in New Orleans that were just remittance offices that did that, sent this money back to Ireland to get tickets to bring over more family members. So that bridge between the two places was open. And that possibility existed. Again, if you didn't get killed by a disease or a shipwreck or, you know, something else that was one of the dangers of the era.
We, my guest, of course, Franz, is Dr. Laura Kelly. How do you pronounce it? You're a New Orleanian?
New Orleanian, yes.
Oh, my God, I got that one on the first go. Okay, very proud of myself. Let me ask you, though, about the recognition of the Irish Channel. What was the Irish Channel? Was that was that a cocoon for Irish? How did it get that name? And does it still exist?
Yes, and good questions. So the Irish Channel is the name of a neighborhood here in New Orleans, And New Orleans is a city that is made up by very distinct neighborhoods. You know, we have the Treme, we have the Marigny, we have the Bywater, we have the Garden District, and all these things, and they all have very clearly defined borders, except for the Irish Channel.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that's just a representative of the Irish personality, because everybody argues over what exactly are those boundaries. Some make it as narrow as one street, Adele Street. Others make it much broader. Everybody argues in between those two. So it's along the Mississippi River. It's upriver from the French Quarter. So if you've been to New Orleans, it's upriver from there. St. Alphonse's Church, which was the church for the Irish, kind of anchors the Irish Channel there. And it's not the only Irish community. We had multiple Irish communities throughout neighborhoods, throughout the city. And we had ones that were below the French Quarter, one that was in the middle of the city. And, you know, the easiest way to find out where they, where the Irish settled is to see where they built their churches. And, and they built their churches all over. And they, then they brought in Irish priests, and then they brought in, you know, the Irish female religious orders. And that, to me, is like, that's the easiest way I can find it. And I think I would do that for sort of any city in America in the 19th century. Look for those things, and you'll find where the Irish are. The name is also up for debate, and lots of people argue, and there's no definitive evidence over where that name came from. But it's because of the Irish Channel that I ended up doing my PhD in the Irish New Orleans. My grandfather came from County Roscommon, and I had, even though I grew up with this knowledge and I was very close with my grandfather, it hadn't occurred to me to study the Irish in New Orleans. I think just as much as your audience is surprised to learn about them. And it was that same taxi ride my first day in the city, and I'm speaking to this guy thinking he's from New York City, and he's telling me he's from the Channel, and the what, the Channel, the Irish Channel, and I'm like, what is that? And I thought, I need to look into this. And I did, and that's when I found out that there was this large population of Irish in New Orleans, but really very, very little research had been done. And so I said, well, bingo, it's fine. And so, you know, that steered the direction of my research right then and there.
They've done one heck of a job. Again, I'd like to, wrap up where we began, and the story, and one that I don't think many of us were aware of, was that there was this town, Carrigallen, in County Leitrim, and they have done tremendous work over the years, some of it indeed spurred by your own book called The Irish in New Orleans. And their committee there is headed by a girl, Kathy Lyons, who heads the committee in Carrigallen. But it brings attention, and I could hardly believe that in, you know, relatively narrow roads there are tour buses and mini buses and cars and people going. As we were driving the road, I thought this must be a funeral or something, and then I said, wait a minute, two buses at a funeral? I don't think so. And sure enough, it was there. Margaret of New Orleans, our Margaret, the bread woman of New Orleans, and mother of orphans, the house itself where she was born, and she wasn't a Harry when she left. She was actually a Gaffney, I believe. Was it?
Right.
Gaffney?
Yeah.
So it was, again, the townland of Tully, Carrigallen, And it is a place that, indeed, when they say it restored, and it's now restored, they are, you know, they are refurbishing to its original just about every part of that. It's a great place to visit. The cottage itself is amazing and well worth a visit. And a lot of things happening over there, including a full-length movie and play. And again, there are those who say that might have been lost to history had it not been for our guest, Dr. Laura Kelly. And thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for bringing attention to this, because the work they've done there is just amazing. And I think the more people know about Margaret, the better it is. You know, the second public statue to a woman in the United States was to her. And here in New Orleans. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, to me, she, in many ways, she epitomized the Irish immigrant experience of so many different women. But then what she did with it was just phenomenal and amazing and inspiration to everyone.
And indeed, the renewed interest is also very welcome. My guest, Dr. Laura Kelly, and her book is The Irish in New Orleans, and it can be found on Amazon and many other fine bookstores. Thank you, Laura, and friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, The Flannelly Show.
Great. Well, thank you again. And if people want to reach out to me, you can always reach me via my website, which is Laura D. Kelly, and that's spelled with an E-Y, .com. So everybody, welcome, and thanks again, and it was great speaking with you.
Thank you.